and just got up and walked out because the issue had really been determined in the decision about, you know, voting or not in the actual voting. And Dan Dixon was elected. Dixon...
Was Dixon elected at this meeting from which Johnson had walked out? So Johnson...
Yes, that's right.
So
Johnson...
Dixon was not Johnson's man.
Dixon was not Johnson's man. And they had a brief... They had a few words for each other. Dixon wanting to work with Johnson. Afterwards, Johnson telling him that he had another thought coming before that ever happened. And once again, the interests of the community, in John Johnson's terms, were not going to be served by the Black Student Association. It is obvious that Rodney Hammond, in becoming president of the new organization called BSA, was very much a step towards better community-university relations as far as John Johnson was concerned. This is borne out to a great degree by Rodney's planning and teaching of a Black history course in the North End this very last summer. Now...
And most of what you're saying is based upon conversations with John Johnson the last 2 days, or is this background that you've known a long time?
This was not background that I had known a long time ago. This did come out today in a conversation with Johnson and Smith, Joe Smith. Dixon, as it turns out, was still able to maintain a certain relationship with the community and was supposedly instrumental in pushing for a certain, you know, amount of community university interaction. In any respect, Dixon was not as bad in Johnson's terms, views, as David Addison has turned out to be. John takes a certain amount of credit for David's becoming president of BSA. For it was during Dan Dixon's term in office, at the time of the Orange Tree, I believe, Orange Tree Massacre, that a policy statement was presented to the BSA Executive Committee, which John Johnson saw or heard about. This policy statement, after being read by John, he asked, you know, he told Rodney Hammond, who had presented it, that Rodney hadn't written it. And in fact, Rodney hadn't written it. Instead, David Addison had. Prior to this time, David had no connection with the Black Student Association. It was after this time that a certain force in BSA, which was distinctive from Dan Dixon's constituency among the Black fraternity and sorority students, rallied around David, who became the new leader of BSA. In my opinion, David was the first person to truly unite all the forces in BSA, although they, in fact, do remain to this day very distinct groups which have found a certain interest in common under David's leadership. Largely, this interest has been an identification of themselves as black leaders who would ultimately return to their communities to do some good. And I think it's a further identification of themselves as black participants in society as a whole. This becomes a very difficult point to understand for their participation in society as a whole is premised upon their being able to identify strongly with black culture and in fact probably create a new black culture, an Afro-American culture, which they carry as signs of their blackness more than what one would consider the sign of blackness that John Johnson is interested in, namely the sign of an average problem-plagued black community. These people have a good idea that they've made it and have a good idea of wanting to maintain a distinct identity about them as they continue to operate in an alien society in which they understand very well that they have a secure place.
But it's a kind of, what you say, a kind of cleaned up culture, basically, that you're saying that they're shooting for. That was when Addison and company talk about Afro-American studies, they're not portraying the Negro as he is, but as they would sort of like him to be. Is this it? Whereas Johnson is more fascinated by the way the Negro is.
I think that may be true. There's a certain, you know, clean hands feeling about it. I don't think they have been as active in the community as they have been active with each other in trying to distinguish themselves from the rest of the white student body.
Yes,
okay. This is one of the problems, ultimately, that will have to be wrestled with in the resolution of this week's events.
Now, how much of this analysis that we're putting on this actually was the substance of discussion this afternoon with Johnson and Smith? Are you basically painting what you gather, or were these things discussed as you're discussing them now explicitly?
These things, possibly not in the same terms or words, were explicitly discussed
this afternoon.
And I felt that they have introduced an interesting and important facet to the problem.
Now let me ask you a question. Miriam Sheldon always refers to Joe Smith as Joe Smith and his umbrella. We all know that Joe speaks with a remarkably cultured accent. Did you find Smith taking Addison's position this afternoon as a sort of an opponent of Johnson in this discussion, or was Smith acting neutral, or was Smith agreeing with Johnson, or just what were the dynamics of the conversation? You've conveyed the topic, but you haven't conveyed what roles people were playing in the conversation.
Well, beginning with Joe, I think he took to an outside observer, he would have, you know, would have been assumed that he had taken a neutral, really non-participatory, you know, part in, you know, the discussion. He was being a very good administrator. On the other hand, knowing Joe's involvement in many of the activities that I've participated in, knowing his desire to open up the university to the community, to a significant degree, such as in recreational facilities and in cultural arts programs, and even more expanded programs if possible. I believe that Joe was very much sympathetic with with John Johnson's community viewpoint. And it is ironic that Joe, without the trappings of black militancy, would in fact be more concerned about problems arising in the ghetto that could best be, you know, attacked from within a university in certain ways, that he would, you know, take this position, although he is much more sophisticated and probably appears much more white than many of the black militants, and I put that word in quotation marks, black militants in the Black Student Association, who are in fact very much desirous in a way of not participating in the nitty-gritty affairs of community problems, but may instead desire to return to their own individual communities someday to be the college-educated liberator of their people. I mentioned some of these things, and they seem like labeling at this point, but I mentioned them in order to have them down so that some psychological conclusions or generalizations may be
possible.
One thing was also brought up at this discussion between Smith and Johnson and myself, and that was that there is a strong fear on the part of John Johnson that David Addison may be seeking through a Machiavellian type maneuver to benefit the posture of BSA by obtaining a black student center and a black history course in the university, in addition to other demands that he's making, that BSA is making, while at the expense of the community and certain people in the community. Now, the Black Student Center idea has been discussed in the past between BSA and the Chancellor, and ultimately the Chancellor said, if you find the house, we'll rent it. The house was never found. Joe Smith relates, talking to Bill Savage, who is presently on the Exec Committee of BSA, in which discussion Joe asked, do you want a black student or, you know, cultural arts center, or do you want BSA to have one? The implication being that an issue was framed between a community university center as contrasted to a BSA center. And there is a certain frame of mind that is running through as a common thread through many of the activities in this area, which seems to be...
You mean BSA activities?
Which BSA activities, not just BSA activities, but I mean Project 500 activities, community activities in which BSA is involved, or even university activities as far as how black students would participate in them. But the common thread that I speak of is that BSA is almost, it's difficult to express, is seeking to control any activity
that involves
black people.
It's a unionization, basically, right?
Well, it's a unionization, and depending on what you mean by it, it's
collective bargaining. It's spokesman.
It's certainly collective bargaining. The problems with that type of collective bargaining involve problems of, you know, the relation of community blacks to the university and ultimately to university blacks. Problems of who speaks for the community, whether, you know, community blacks can or whether BSA, you know, will. Whether BSA can even. There are problems,
Don't you see some parallel between this situation and that that's being played out by the Graduate Student Association? There's always a difficulty of who your constituency is, and there's also a problem of staffing. In fact, I was reminded as I sat in the BSA office the other day with Addison, I was reminded of GSA's early days because he had a girl sitting at the desk typing for him in the BSA office. And he was discussing with her whether she'd ever been paid for her clerical work that she did for the university this last summer. She was a recruiter, but then she had a lot of paperwork to do after the recruiting period was over. And he wanted the office clean, and he was obviously acting as a student bureaucrat, basically the way Morrison does. His black kids were coming in and saying, I don't know quite what to do about registering. They had all kinds of little nitty-gritty problems. And it seemed to me that when he made his demand today at the AAUP meeting, for a budget and for staff, he was doing really just about what Morrison did a year ago when he was trying to set the Graduate Student Association up and got money from the Graduate College. And in fact, not only is there a similarity between the two, but we must remember that Addison is in constant contact with Morrison and has some notion of the path that the Graduate Student Association has taken.
That may very well be true, and if I can just add, you know, John Johnson was one of the, you know, people, or he at least credits himself with being a person that advised the Black Student Association, David Addison included, that they had to have money, and that, in fact, John was one of the people, you know, behind this whole 500 program, initially entering into the negotiations, maybe even initiating the negotiations, seeking to have, you know, black students from Champaign enter the program or enter the university. And when things caught on, he was in the forefront suggesting that 5,000 students be brought, knowing full well, but not letting very many other people know full well, that he was really kidding.
Dramatizing
and negotiating.
Yes.
Anyway.
Well, I only bring this up because you mentioned it as if it had been a sinister thread running through this whole story that maybe BSA was trying to get a monopoly on the black spokesman position. And I was just asking if you really think there was a serious difference between what they were trying to do and what the GSA was doing. It seems to me that for sheerly
yes.
administrative reasons, you would want that kind of a position.
Yes, but I see there are serious differences.
Okay.
Since the community here is an organization that has to, or is an environment which has to be, the black community is an environment which has to be organized from within itself, and that its relation to the university has to be independent of that of BSA. Although they may have some, you know, common interests and can support one another's, you know, demands or, you know, relations or negotiations, that it is foolhardy for a black student association which is interested in black problems to dissociate itself not only as an independent body, but also as an almost supervening body and spokesman for a truly, you know, separate constituency of blacks. The frustrating thing about the Black Student Association's stance is its segmentation of the university community without any true bridge of significance being built with the blacks or for the blacks or between them and the blacks in the Champaign-Urbana area.
So it's acting more as a divisive influence at the moment than it is as a welding influence between the community and the university.
Yes, and I believe that this is one of the problems, major problems probably, in the ultimate resolution of the events of the recent week.
Okay.
For the way in which a compromise is most likely to be reached, as indicated by the Chancellor's speech, as indicated by the Pines' request, and as indicated by several and various sources as a projection into the future. Well, this way that is being projected or thought of is that since certain people were responsible for damage in the incident, and since the great majority of people were not responsible for any damage, that the program itself can proceed and proceed well if it cannot be blamed or if it won't be blamed. And this is possible by only blaming the limited few who were responsible for any damage.
Okay.
And proceeding against them harshly in order to satisfy certain of the monkeys on Chancellor Pelteson's back, the more conservative elements in the state, those elements which are truly against the program.
Okay, now I think here we've made this situation very clear, and that's important, but now I think we have to get very specific about information that is direct and firsthand. Now, of course, this conversation that we're just having now is almost identical, except for the details you've been filling in, with the one that we had Friday night late, when we came to the same conclusion, that the way for the people to get out of the corners in which they painted themselves was for the Black Students Association to give, the Black Student Association and the community to give on their apparent position that no one would be allowed to take individual blame for this damage, and that in fact people were going to have to be named, particularly people who assaulted other individuals. Now, after we left that meeting at the center, which was here, you and I were discussing this after David Pines and his wife went home. After that meeting broke up, you met John Johnson on the street. And now I think maybe it'd be useful, contradictory if you don't agree, to tell us what happened with Johnson and how you think that affected the development of the next couple of days.
Johnson and I and Teddy Edwards had breakfast, really, about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning at the Red Wheel, and we were together for approximately 2.5 hours. During which time, John and I discuss the possibility of having a compromise situation occur. Now, my feelings at that time was that the university could proceed one of three ways. It could either let or the chancellor could proceed one of three ways. He could let, the process occur as it will, not trying to influence the disciplinary procedures, not trying to influence the stance that the president or the board of trustees would take, and basically not trying to influence, you know, the further development and inaction on the program itself. Well, this has been utterly impossible for him to do, especially, you know, when it concerned the administration of the program. However, it is still, you know, open to question how much of an influence he will assert in the disciplinary action and in the, you know, public stance that the university shall take. It seems like his feelings are that the university shall not go public, largely according to William Williams, because he doesn't feel capable of carrying on a public fight as a personal matter. And he feels that if he were more competent and capable of such a thing, he would probably do it. However, he only sees himself doing more harm than good if he does undertake such activity at this point. However, the other extreme position that could be taken by the Chancellor would be to go public, and as I've just discussed that, he does not, you know, seek to do this for fear of flaming any reactionary flames that are already underway, and by intimidating and forcing the public prosecutor, the state's attorney, into a rigid position where he would have to prosecute fully each of the students arrested, but instead wants to achieve the leniency that, or the moderation that is possible by doing things on a non-public basis, such as getting the charges dropped without having the prosecutor exposed to public opinion, which is in favor of having the charges prosecuted. Well, the middle ground, which is the best in my opinion, is somehow reaching some kind of compromise, as I have, you know, briefly outlined prior to this, where, you know, somebody who's done damage does carry the brunt of the blame, so that the student, the larger group of students, are not given the blame, and they, as well as the program, can continue. However, in doing this sort of thing, the relationship of the program and all other, you know, facets of the program and environment which relate to the community come into being. This happens because one of the instigators, supposedly, of the damage was Stevie Jackson, who was very vocal and very militant at the sit-in.
McNabb, Robert McNabb, union supervisor, personnel, long, good standing with the university, only a few years short of retirement, said to me at the morning of the arrests, approximately 5:30 in the morning, said to me that there were only four people involved in any damage to any of the property in the two lounges. He did not mention by name any of them. However, there has been many rumors to the effect that Stevie Jackson, who had been instrumental, as I said, in vocalizing a great deal of agitation, was in some way, either directly or indirectly, for the property damage in the lounges. It may not have been Stevie himself who was, you know, who did any of the actual damage directly. However, it's more than likely that it was either he or some of his, you know, close associates in the North End either non-students or possibly even students in the program who were ultimately responsible for doing the actual damage, or for actually doing the damage. The problems in pigeonholing these people for stern or, you know, harsh action, disciplinary and possibly even civil, the prosecution of the criminal charges against them, arise in trying to stabilize the relationship between the community and the university. John Johnson, in the early morning meeting that I had had with him, described to me his situation vis-a-vis Stevie Jackson. They have often been at opposite ends of different arguments. There is no doubt that they both appeal to different young groups of blacks in the North End. Stevie's the head of